Okay, good morning, everyone. Welcome to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast. I'm Rachel Smith, COO with Exchange Wire. Delighted to have here in the studio with us today our very special guest, Ryan Kangasa, partner at MediaSense. Hi, Ryan.
Hello. Welcome. Good to be here.
Yeah, great to have you. And in the hot seat this week, a little bit of a break from Kieron, I'm delighted to see Lindsay Rowntree, Head of Content at Exchange Wire. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi.
Lindsay was off last week moving into your new house, weren't you, Lindsay?
Yeah, it's been hell.
Yeah.
Yeah. I never want to move again. You know, Rachel, you know very well yourself.
Yeah. I do, yeah. When we were talking about, what were we talking about a lot last year? I feel like we were talking about furniture purchasing habits. And so there was a lot of... Recently, I've had to purchase a fridge. So we'll get on to DTC later.
Yeah. You can
probably.
Yeah. Well, there'll be lots of that, yeah. It's very, very relevant to me right now.
Cool. So let's get started on news of the week. The first story that I wanted to chat with the two of you about is the news that came out this week that Altice has bought Cheddar for $200 million. So Cheddar is a live streaming financial news network, and this is also an all cash deal. So it feels like great news for Cheddar. Really good news for the co-founder. Interesting to hear Altice coming out doing something like this, because it feels like it was not that long ago that they bought who'd they buy? Was it?
It was Teeds.
Teeds. I was going to say Teeds, yeah. And then I thought I was going to get that wrong.
But then I don't know the difference really between what Altice USA is and what Altice more globally is, because Altice, right, I know is a Dutch telco.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Altice USA, I don't know how involved they are with the Dutch side of it, or if they're a completely separate unit or what, because it definitely states that Altice USA bought Cheddar. So I'm not, so whoever knows how Altice works as a business, let us know.
Give us a call. Yeah. Come in for a podcast.
Yeah. Do our jobs for us, because we haven't got a clue.
Yeah, totally. Well, it's interesting because, you know, again, it feels like sort of late last year we talked a lot about telcos and telcos' acquisition of technology tools and looking to kind of get into the ad tech and martech scene. And you know, and when they have acquired various tools, it's not always been clear how they've integrated those into the business. Mm-hmm. So this is kind of interesting yet again. Obviously, it's a bit more on the content side of things. And it's quite interesting because, you know, this is sort of a native live streaming platform as well. So interested to know what you guys think of this acquisition, what you think of it, Ryan, particularly interested in your view from a marketer perspective, because that's your sort of client pool. Mm-hmm. And what does this mean for Altice and streaming? Because it looks like they're now sort of trying to enter into that video streaming zone, which is heavily competitive.
Yeah.
Ryan.
Well, I mean, I think first thing to say is, you know, it seems on paper, you know, a very smart and shrewd acquisition. I have to confess, you know, I haven't come across Cheddar a huge amount. And, you know, understandably, you know, it's a very domestic service is what I gather. But since playing around and looking at the app, I mean, it's a great format. The content's very accessible. It feels very new and very fresh. And you can see why it caters very well for that millennial audience. You know, for brands, you know, their biggest challenge is how do you reach younger audiences who can't be found, you know, as effectively through traditional media. So for one, you know, this, if Altice can help to scale that, I mean, it's clear the commercial proposition for Cheddar isn't, you know, it isn't terribly clear. They monetize their content through distribution, but the advertising proposition isn't that developed. So I imagine, expect Altice will develop that and make that much more available to brands seeking that young audience. But, you know, look, it's interesting, especially, you know, with recent news about BuzzFeed and Vice and all those layoffs, you know, Cheddar is definitely bucking that trend. And it's I guess because they're playing in an area of content that isn't as saturated. You know, it's not entertainment content, it's factual news. It's not terribly partisan, it's very accessible, and it's native, I guess, to, you know, the modern desire now for news media that isn't partisan, that isn't skewed or biased in any way.
And a new way to consume that news content, like you say.
Yeah.
Lindsay, what's your view on this?
I think it's very interesting. From what I know of Cheddar, I mean, I didn't know of Cheddar anyway as a kind of live streaming news platform, but they also, as Ryan said, they have this millennial generation that they are targeting, which is an area, particularly you've got Cheddar Business and Cheddar News, like the news section is an area where, you know, the millennials aren't really targeted when it comes to news. You've got kind of, if you think of the rolling headline things in the US, like Fox News, for example, you know, them trying to kind of take that audience away from them is interesting. And apparently it's very prevalent at petrol stations or gas stations to US audience, of course, and on college campuses as well. So that is where they are going, and that's where their visibility is. So actually, from a targeting perspective, it's interesting. From an advertiser perspective, it's also interesting, depending on how Cheddar wants to monetize that. But also, I find it fascinating from the broader kind of TV, video, media landscape in the US in general. And I guess if you haven't seen Recode, have got this amazing map they put together that shows who owns what in the kind of the current streaming wars. And if you haven't seen it, it's such a good map. And Altice USA is in there, little tiny blob at the bottom that recently acquired I-24 News and News 12 Networks. And if you look at the likes of AT&T and Comcast and what, you know, who they've owned, who they've bought, Altice trying to get into that play of kind of looking at the kind of the streaming things. Obviously, AT&T owned CNN, like they own Turner CNN. So actually, that they've got the kind of more adult, if you like, the older generation news section. If Altice are looking to go to the younger generation, this is very interesting, and kind of turn it all into Altice News to actually see it be seen as a credible competitor in that space, I think is absolutely fascinating as a kind of relative unknown in the industry so far.
Yeah.
And you were sort of making as well, Lindsay, a point about LinkedIn Live, saying that they're testing their beta platform, and that you think that it was something that, you know, that a platform like Cheddar will make use of.
I do. I was invited to the LinkedIn Live beta, and it's quite interesting. I think that LinkedIn Live is actually a really good idea, because I can see a lot of companies already. My first thought was, oh, the likes of CNN would love this kind of thing, to be able to actually have live streaming, and LinkedIn will love it because it's native, and LinkedIn love native content. Live streaming from all these different news channels, also things like, you know, backstage at events and that kind of thing. From a business perspective, it works really well. And actually, this could be a play for Cheddar and the new Altice News. I think the likes of LinkedIn Live and other streaming platforms, they already use Sling and Dish and those kind of things as well. I think that would work really well for them.
Yeah, I'd agree. I mean, I don't think it's a priority for Cheddar, because they have so much distribution already. And I'm still unsure whether LinkedIn is the right environment for streaming news. I mean, I think a lot of us consume it at work, you know, sound off, or maybe on a mobile device, again, sound off. So it'd be interesting, but, you know, it's also curious why LinkedIn have taken this long to launch a streaming or a live streaming service compared with some of the other platforms.
And what about, we've touched on it a little bit already, but what about the opportunity here, I suppose, for news focused content and content providers that are looking to, you know, to sort of increase their distribution? Does it feel like this sort of live streaming platform is a real opportunity that others could build out and grow? Because, like you just said earlier on, if you think about the way that millennials consume content, it's totally different. And I was just having a conversation actually with some friends that are visiting from Australia and their 18-year-old kids, who were saying, you know, who have actually never read a newspaper ever, because they've never, by the time they got interested in news, their parents stopped reading physical newspapers. So they've only ever consumed news online. And they probably consume that largely through social media channels, and are still only really recognizing the difference between social media posts and news. Of course, that's a whole other debate.
Of course.
But is this an opportunity, do you think, for content providers and content producers?
Well, look, I don't think we need more live news. I think we just need better news. And clearly Cheddar have found a format and a way of delivering that news. And you know, it helps the topics in which they focus are very current. You know, that it doesn't need a 30-minute, you know, debate about, you know, what's going on in the stock market. You know, it's just very accessible. So I think it's, you know, they're differentiating through format rather than just, you know, another live news service.
That's a really good point, actually.
I think as well, if you look at the way that the younger generation actually consumes news as well, they do live in like kind of a headline world. They don't ever go into detail. Like, as you're saying, they don't need the 30-minute debate, right? And they literally look at headline. If you look at the way that a YouTube video is labelled now, like the headline of a YouTube video is about you know, 20 lines long, because you've got the entire information about the entire video and everything that will happen throughout it in the headline, because nobody reads the description.
Yeah.
And that's what the headline world now is. And I think Cheddar played to that really, really well. So you get all the information and make your own assumptions just from those few words.
Yeah.
But look, I think, you know, if we just think about the last 2 or 3 years and, you know, in the world of fake news, you know, you go to Sky News now and the first line you see is, you know, why you can trust us. Mm. You know, and there's a real, you know, crisis of trust around news media. And, you know, the fact that Cheddar are able to come in and disrupt that, you know, again, it's not overly partisan, it's factual. Again, just helps differentiate what is, you know, a toiling, you know, industry at the moment, where everyone is trying to kind of build back up the trust that they had.
Yeah, and find their place within that. But it would be really interesting, wouldn't it? Because, I mean, you know, the death of 30-minute segments debating non-news would just be great for everyone in the world, wouldn't it? Gone are the days when anyone's got the time for that. And I sort of feel like it's become redundant, even if it's, you know, it's accidentally become redundant. Bring it on. Anyway, going on a separate rant there. Right, second news story I wanted to discuss with you guys was Google making an announcement this week that which could be seen as them going all in on brand safety, saying that it's going to default to ads.txt approved inventory. So this is really interesting, because obviously we've had quite a few conversations here on the Mad Tech podcast and in general at ATS events and in Exchange Wire content about ads.txt, its adoption, you know, its focus, and then how the IAB Tech Labs are rolling out further iterations of it, so add docs.txt in an in-app environment, and the importance of this for the industry. And now Google are kind of, you know, standing behind it, saying this is going to be the bare minimum standard that we will expect for all inventory across our offering. So I'm interested in your views on this, what it says about ads.txt, also what it does to publishers' inventory. And, you know, in preparative discussions, we were talking about the difference between big publishers and small publishers, how that's going to be managed, and what accessing inventory on Google properties will look like after this. Ryan?
Yeah, sure. Look, I mean, I think it's a welcome move by Google, but, you know, it's also not a panacea for brand safety. You know, ads.txt addresses brand safety just like it addresses fraud, but it's not going to fully protect brands from appearing in content in which they don't want to appear. You know, there are, you know, hyper-partisan websites like Breitbart, like the Rebel Media, like the Canary, you know, which may have ads.txt implemented, but that's not necessarily brand safe. And, you know, it's also representative of Google. You know, I think, you know, if we see the world outside of just DV360, and, you know, I know you guys support independent ad tech, you know, as do we, you know, I think we need to be looking at this as what is the industry doing, rather than just, you know, take comfort in the fact that Google are pushing this through and brand safety is being addressed.
Yeah,
I completely agree with that. Actually, I guess for me, it feels a bit self-serving in that, you know, Google are trying to prove that they are adopting brand safe practices to try to get more business. And it's the independent ad tech that's probably been doing this for a while anyway, that have already been always been prioritizing and like, you know, only running ads on brand safe inventory, ads.txt approved inventory, and Google now doing the same thing. Actually, I don't know if it means very much. On the one hand, it's obviously a great idea, and it's very, very important that they are supporting brand safety and supporting ads.txt as much as possible. But on the other hand, there is still more that can be done. And then from a publisher perspective, you know, I've got views on the other side of it. Like, I think from the top 1,000 publishers, something like there's a report somewhere that says, I think 74% of those publishers all have ads.txt files. Mm. So they're all fine and safe, if you like. I'm using air quotes there, because it is, what does safe mean? Ryan, as you said, you can be on the Canary, you can be on Breitbart. It's not actually brand safe in inventory.
Yeah.
For brands to be safe from that inventory, they need to actually kind of go through the whitelist process, really, just to kind of stop their ads appearing on those kinds of sites. They've got an ads.txt file. It doesn't make them brand safe. So actually, there's a dichotomy there in what it means.
Yeah.
Plus, I think you guys have written about this, you know, the implementation of that code is also not always fail safe. And is it 25%, I think, of the top 1,000 also, you know, there's the identified errors in that code. So, again, yeah. This is good hygiene, but it's not, as I say, it's not a panacea.
It's not a fix.
You know, it needs to be looked at in the context of all brand safety, fraud, mitigation. And, you know, this is a good move, but it's not the only move.
No, exactly. And from a publisher's perspective, there are many sites that haven't got Azure TXT files, and it means they will need to go ahead and do that. And obviously Google will make sure they communicate with those publishers accordingly to say you're basically
what
switched
you need
off
to do.
Unless you implement that. But I also question kind of the AdSense side of things, where obviously an AdSense has to be listed on the Azure TXT file as well. Google can't bypass that because it's its own product. That's not the way it works. Otherwise it would make them, you know, very much marking your own homework territory. But a lot of the kind of the very, very small independent publishers that use AdSense, they won't have a bloody clue what an Azure TXT file is or how to implement it. And yes, you can say, well, Google will give them advice on how to do it. That doesn't mean that you're kind of the average Joe walking down the street that might have a little restaurant blog or something will have a clue what you're talking about.
No.
Until they find that their AdSense revenue gets cut off, and then they think, oh, I need to implement this now. And yes, if they use WordPress, there'll probably be plugins and that kind of thing. But again, a lot of your average people don't know what a plugin is or how to implement it properly on their blog that they are making money, a bit of money through here and there. So I think it will affect those smaller independent publishers, the kind of the long tail publishers, quite significantly. And in turn, that will affect advertisers because they actually offer a very rich source of audience. People that kind of read those sort of sites on a regular basis, not just the kind of the top premium publishers that everyone seems to focus on.
Yep.
So I find that I think that will be interesting, and you'll probably start to see an uplift in those plugins that do help with Azure TXT files on the likes of WordPress. But also you'll start to see a lot more confusion and even more errors probably around what is actually on an Azure TXT file.
Yep.
If the premium publishers can't get that right and they actually have ad ops teams, I don't imagine the smaller ones to be able to get it correct either.
Yeah. But I suppose there's so many different ways you could take this. So the first is that, yeah, okay, you know, is it Google just sort of, using this as a kind of catch-all minimum standard and saying, yep, that's it, we've done our bit for, for brand safety? Or is it actually something that the industry's wanted for a long time anyway? Like you said, Ryan, you know, it's kind of welcome development because we've been talking about how important it is for everybody to adopt ads.txt. This is a way for Google to sort of enforce it amongst everybody that advertisers. So, you know, that's not a bad thing. Yes, there's going to be a transition period where it's going to be difficult for some to adopt, and there's certainly going to be a lot of small publishers that won't know what the hell's going on. But maybe that's just a necessary, you know, headache in order to get to a place where we've got good hygiene.
Yeah,
like
I mean,
mentioned.
I think publishers have always been agitating for this, especially those that have had all these resellers and, you know, domain spoofing and all of that. But, you know, I think for brands, it hasn't been something they've been aware of. You know, they run a piece of activity, they see a domain report through a verification partner, and they just see, you know, premium publishers. They're not necessarily seeing what sits behind that and why ads.txt is so important. So I think that's, you know, they're through this, they're going to clearly engage more, better, you know, understand it a bit better. So it should just be another tick box, you know, good hygiene, but you know, there's clearly more to it.
There's more behind it. Because then the other thing that I noticed was a little bit of a debate amongst, you know, the ad tech community ensue after this announcement about the effectiveness altogether of ads.txt. And, you know, there was a bit of a debate about what it did. And, you know, then in the office we had a follow-on conversation because we do quite a bit of work with IAB Tech Labs, and we were all saying that, you know, it's just one piece, small piece of many things that you have to do to clean the environment up. Right. And not only are there further iterations of the technology, but it also needs to be accepted that it's almost a solution that's been applied to an imperfect situation. So it's not going to be the perfect solution. And we kind of have to live with that as an industry.
Yeah. And I think it should always be viewed as IAB Tech Labs' first attempts. It's an ongoing iterative process, right? It was their first attempt to try to start getting people to understand brand safety and people to start working within brand safe environments.
Yeah.
It was never going to be the catch-all solution, as well, to the panacea for everything. It certainly wasn't. But that's where, you know, they're evolving it over time. That's where ads.cert comes into play. That's where you've got the flip side, so that publishers have more security against advertisers with sellers.json. You've also got app ads.txt coming along as well. So it is constantly evolving, and ads.txt certainly is by no means perfect. It is easily manipulated, and all it takes is for, you know, a dodgy ad net to call up an advertiser and say, hey, you know, we've been working with you guys for years. If you just make sure that your publishers that you work with put us on their text files, then it's all going to be fine.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of practice, it's still happening.
Yeah.
You can't escape that sort of stuff, but it does actually just require more vigilance. You can't use a text file as a panacea.
Yeah.
It needs to be created more awareness, basically.
Yeah. And maybe it's going to lead to exactly what you said then, Ryan, creating more awareness across the piece. As you say, what does it mean to marketers and brands? It hasn't meant a lot until now, but maybe this is going to start to bring things to the forefront. Obviously, brand safety is important to them, but they haven't necessarily been in a position to either understand or appreciate the process that goes into creating that environment. Yeah. And, you know, more visibility on that, even if it's in the form of debate, is probably worthwhile.
But it's, you know, it's, again, it's more than just brand safety. I mean, you know, if you know, fraud is, you know, as we know, the I feel there's a different percentage every day, depending on the report you see.
Yeah.
But even, you know, just in terms of the performance of campaigns, you know, the working media, clearly, if they can eradicate those resellers, then their working media will improve. Therefore, the reach and the performance will improve in turn. Yeah. So, you know, this is, you know, it's will hopefully tick a lot of those boxes. But there's a, you know, again, not to labour the point, there's other elements to it, be it outside of as.txt. And, you know, it's just, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about, you know, brand safety remains a key issue for clients.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's sufficient confidence, you know, whether it's coming out of the publishers, agencies, platforms, that it is yet a fully, you know, fail-safe solution, or, you know, that there is a fail-safe solution there.
Yeah, it's more complex than that.
Mm.
Okay, moving on to our third story for the week. It's, you know, surprise, surprise, on direct-to-consumer, I feel like.
Shocker.
I know. I feel like we talk about it a lot at ExchangeWire, but there's
just
a good reason
for that.
We love
it so much.
Exactly. There's a good reason for that. It was an interesting article that appeared in DigiDay this week focusing on why P&G, the fact that P&G have been pretty acquisitive in the last kind of 18 months when it comes to direct-to-consumer brands, and that they've got plans to quite possibly purchase more direct-to-consumer brands. Why this is interesting to us is because it speaks a lot to the way in which CPGs are organising themselves from a business perspective. It also speaks to how they're handling the sort of DTC marketplace and where they see the opportunity in these digitally native brands. So I'm interested to hear your perspective on this, whether it means that, whether it's saying something about how CPG brands are kind of taking their heritage brands and trying to find a place, I suppose, on the shelf, in the supermarket, in the high street for those brands alongside some of these digitally native brands, or is it that actually they're looking to acquire them for really specific purposes? You know, is it a data play? Is it an opportunity to connect with a different type of audience? And what does it say generally for the kind of direction of travel for CPG brands versus smaller digitally native independent brands? Ryan?
Yeah, I mean, how long have we got?
Yeah.
I mean, look, aside from the fact these businesses are very, you know, are growing, they're very profitable, and I'm sure will be a very, you know, very good acquisition. What they give CPG, and, you know, we have a lot of experience with, you know, a number of these brands, is the things that those brands don't have. You know, they don't have speed, they don't have agility, they don't have deep customer relationships, they don't have the capability to really drive that transformation. You know, they are encumbered by, you know, decades and decades of working in a very similar way, very decentralized, somewhat archaic. You know, these D2C brands come along, they're very centralized, they're very data driven, they're very, you know, they take risks. Again, another thing that CPG can't do. So, you know, they're just, you know, it's almost more acqui-hire than, you know, just acquiring, you know, these businesses, because they will help in turn to transform what is, you know, a very, I know we talk about, you know, fast moving consumer goods, actually slow moving organizations who are desperate for that transformation, but just so held back by just, you know, decades of kind of traditional thinking and ways of working.
Mm.
You know, I think when Unilever bought Dollar Shave Club, it was Unilever. You know, they spoke about buying their e-commerce capability.
Yeah.
You know, more than just buying, you know, a fast-growing business.
Yeah. And that's a really interesting point. We were sort of talking about that, in preparation for this chat as well, is to what extent is any of the way that DTC brands organise themselves a sort of segue to accessing a useful business transformation tool? And to what extent are CPGs, like you say, it's really interesting that picture that you paint. They're desperate for some kind of catalyst for change and to disrupt what's happening within their organisations, because I guess they can see the way that things are unfolding and they want to innovate and they want to remain fresh. To what extent are they using some of these mechanisms that DTC brands have already got within their, you know, companies and organisations as business transformation tools?
Well, I think the, firstly, just organisationally, you know, CPG tend to be very decentralised, you know, very much market, you know, active in every single market where they have marketing teams and brand teams. And, you know, DTC are very centrally focused. You know, they don't need to operate in lots of markets. They can build teams from the centre. And you see this, you know, a lot of those brands based in, you know, big talent centres in Amsterdam, in other parts of Europe, all over the world. That model allows decision making, you know, is much quicker. The development of content much quicker, the ability to activate data, you know, all these things are just so much quicker because there's fewer hoops to jump through. The ability to really kind of build customer data, build those customer relationships and activate that, again, is something that CPG just haven't had because, you know, they haven't had that first party customer data. So, you know, it's not to say that they will just use that for their own benefit, but they will just learn how you should use data, how you should use technology, and how you can operate in a much, much quicker, more agile way.
Mm. And I guess it's almost as though those DTC brands have not had the opportunity or the need to become siloed. You know, like you say, everything is much more centralized, so they've kind of got this holistic view of how their business is operating and running, and that's the thing that perhaps CPGs have lost in their kind of massive expansion and like you say, they're very decentralized approach where running a product team for, you know, a particular, you know, supermarket shelf brand in one country is completely different to another country, is completely different to another global region.
Yeah. But I think there's also a pro quo in terms of, you know, what the CPG bring the D2C brands is just that, you know, appreciation for branding, for marketing, you know, for comms planning, you know, some of those disciplines which, you know, are easily ignored where, you know, with a D2C brand that is very performance marketing focused. And I think it's I was at the ANA conference a couple of weeks ago, and you know, Terry Kawaja spoke a lot about D2C and something like $20 billion in venture capital being invested in D2C at the moment. But you know, what they forget is the importance of building a brand, and you know, just chasing, you know, a race to the bottom around performance, you know, can be quite short-sighted. So I think, you know, I think there's a mutual benefit there. You know, clearly how they integrate these businesses will be an interesting one to observe. But you know, I think again for D2C, you know, they're able to access, you know, the resources, the purchasing power of these CPG, which, you know, will just help to
huge opportunity for them.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think the purchasing power element of it is interesting because actually, you know, we had a few brands we've had on our DTC podcast. So a good example is Guy Blasky, the founder of Pooch and Mutt, which is a dog food DTC brand, and talking about outside of their online subscription model, which is very successful for them, it's the relationships he's trying to build with physical retailers such as Pets at Home and Waitrose. And it's important for them not just to have the online subscription model, which is a very integral part of their business and obviously helps them have this wealth of first party data and helps them kind of grow and scale, but actually the step beyond that, the step beyond where you've kind of reached peak when it comes to the online market, is actually the physical store side of things. And that's where the CPGs do have the clout. They have the buying power, they have a trading power. And that's where they can help a lot of these DTCs that once they've reached sort of critical mass when it comes to the online side of things, will need the likes of P&G and Unilever to take them to the next the next step, because they are in a lot of cases. And if you look at, there's been very successful large DTC fashion brands like And Other Stories and Allbirds that have now gone, they've gone to the physical store and they're doing it very, very well, you know, and keeping themselves close, they're keeping their headquarters close to their shop front. For example, Covent Garden, the Allbirds store in Covent Garden is literally below Allbirds head office. Like that's the way they're doing things rather than having everything. So they are still very centralized, as Ryan was saying. But there's so much that the CPG, despite the fact that it is an archaic oil tanker versus like the jet ski of a DTC brand, that they can learn as well. But I mean, Ryan talked about catalyst for change. Like, is DTC for the likes of P&G and Unilever, is it actually almost like a business transformation tool as they're trying to transform themselves digitally and become less siloed? Can DTC actually help them do something they've been trying to do for the past decade without much success?
I think, yeah, I mean, it's unquestionable what that can achieve. You know, we've seen over the years, I think, was it Nestle and their digital acceleration team, and they would just parachute people from around the markets into this team in Switzerland and try and immerse them for 2 weeks or however long in digital marketing and best practice digital marketing. But you know, it's, you know, you go back to the office and you just kind of revert into, you know, the way you exactly. And you know, there's just more than just capability. It's just the energy that brings, you know, and just the kind of the fear of failure, which, you know, is probably quite inherent within CPG, is just not there with D2C.
Yeah.
Because they're not, you know, they don't have all the stakeholders and the processes and the governance that holds back a lot of CPG.
I mean, at some point, they probably just also don't have as much at stake. When they're smaller, it's a bit different. Many DTC brands have grown quite rapidly. But when they're smaller, you literally have a lot less at stake. So yes, you might have a business that you feel very passionately about and a staff team of 20 or 30 people who you want to keep employed. But if it all goes, you know, if it all goes tits up, it's not an absolute disaster. Whereas you can see how this happens once companies grow, get much larger, become multinational, whoever is running them, or whoever is anywhere near the top of making decisions that are important must feel an incredible sense of kind of nervousness about taking risks.
Yeah.
You either don't want to because you don't want to be the person that ruined it all, or there's so much more at stake. And you sort of feel like conversely it should be the other way around, but I'm not sure that it always is. I think in large organisations there's probably lots of opportunity for there to be, you know, slow moving kind of just getting on with the day job. But at the very top of those organizations, there is also probably fear of failure.
Yeah, completely. And I don't, you know, CPG investing in companies isn't a new thing. You know, they've had incubators for a long time.
Yeah, P&G.
And maybe some of these acquisitions is just a reflection that, you know, that kind of subtle incubation of vendors, you know, where there isn't that much skin in the game, you know, fundamentally doesn't work in driving that transformation. And the only way to do that is actually, you know, make those big punchy acquisitions and you know, force yourself to integrate and quickly.
Yeah. Okay, well, moving on to the next bit of the podcast, and I wanted to, this conversation is a helpful segue because I wanted to mention, Ryan, a report that you drew to our attention by way of then also talking about what you're up to at MediaSense. So MediaSense is an independent consultancy, and you work with brands on their business models and operating models. Am I right?
Correct. And yes. Media performance and ad tech.
Yep. Okay, cool. And in prep for this, you drew to our attention an interesting report that's been released from Ipsos Mori Omnibus Survey on the percentage of European brands that have allegedly, the report doesn't say allegedly. That's my own little editorial edge there, allegedly shifted programmatic in-house. And all three of us agreed that we were stunned by these results. Like, they're really quite remarkable. Saying something like, you know, 88%, you know, up to sort of 86 to 88% across UK, Germany, France, Spain and Italy of brands are saying that they've brought their programmatic capabilities in-house. And then there's a breakdown of that stat between, you know, moving all of their functions in-house or some of their functions in-house, and it's kind of split sort of 40 to 50%. And I mean, you know, the stats were pretty much the same across all countries. I think France was 88%, Germany 89%, Italy 87%, 86%, Spain 78%, UK 88%. What do you, tell us a bit about what you're up to at MediaSense and what you make of that, because it doesn't sound, it's not familiar to us here at Exchange Wire, and I'd love to hear your view.
You know, I think you said, you used the word remarkable. I mean, it's just, for me, it's just not credible. And I think there's, I think it's almost irresponsible as well, because we, you know, we have, you know, we work with a number of clients, and, you know, they're also asking themselves, you know, what is the optimal operating model for media? Should we in-house? Should we review our agency model? Should we do more, do less? And something like this, you know, brands can be forgiven for thinking, well, God, 86%, you know, why are we not doing it? And I just question who's participated in the survey. You know, I imagine it's a lot of D2C brands who, you know, it's you know, a much simpler process to in-source. In fact, they probably
absolutely that, aren't working with agencies at all, or only in a really small capacity.
Exactly.
And they're running quite basic paid search and Facebook campaigns, correct, that they can easily do internally.
Yeah.
Exactly. But, you know, I think there's a, you know, we see it on both sides. You know, those brands that are exploring it, those who have implemented it and may not have implemented it as effectively as expected. So, you know, what is the fallout? And then we also see it in terms of how agencies are changing their models to be more compatible with clients who, you know, fundamentally just want to take more control. Now, some interpret that as doing it themselves, but what we see is actually just, you know, leaning in, you know, getting closer to some of the tech partners, media platforms, publishers, understanding the process. You know, talk about ads.txt, you know, that's part of the process of taking control, but actually buying and operating and optimizing is very different to just, you know, taking a bit more ownership. So, you know, I think this, you know, there seems to be every day a different piece of research around in-housing, and I can't help thinking there's, you know, maybe certain people pushing it out who are somewhat self-serving because, you know, there's something in it for them by driving this agenda. But, you know, I think there's a responsibility to just look at in-housing in, you know, and from all sides, you know, the stuff we don't see about it, you know, the challenges around talent, around supply and management, procurement, legal, risk, headcount, development, you know, career development of the individuals you bring in, and make sure we're, you know, it's being done for the right reasons, not just because, you know, we've seen a piece of research that suggests
everyone's doing it.
Or it's driven by, you know, a different agenda.
And do you find that? No doubt you'll have a kind of range of clients coming to you that you're working with. Have you found yourself in a position where clients have approached you and said, look, I really feel like I need to get on top of this. What's this in-housing business? Everyone's doing it. And have you gotten to a point in the process with them where you've almost gone, well, actually, you've kind of got things set up appropriately. Maybe you need a bit of a tweak here and a bit of a tweak there, but otherwise, you know what you're doing. Has that happened?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, for some brands, it's absolutely the right thing to do. And I think for a lot of those, in-housing hasn't been a, you know, 2018, 2019 thing. It's been a journey over a number of years. You know, it may have started with SEO. It may have then, you know, moved on to pay search. And now, you know, programmatic is the natural evolution. And that's because they've created a proof of concept. There's buy-in internally. They've established the development paths for the teams. And therefore, you know, it is a logical move. You know, where we see it doesn't work is if it's a complete transformation. You know, you're creating a completely new operating model, and that model isn't compatible with what is perhaps a very traditional business or a very risk averse business. And so, you know, I think that's why, you know, we need to look at it on, you know, on its merits and help clients through that journey. I think where we've seen you know, the kind of negative side of it or the challenging side of it is where silos develop. And, you know, for most brands, the one thing they're trying to achieve is customer-centric communications. In order to do that, and, you know, you need to have all your teams, you know, all your media owners, in inverted commas, you know, those who have money that are allocating to media and are trying to communicate with the customer, you need to have those teams working together so that, you know, you've got one customer and they're not seeing mixed messaging and excessive frequency because it's just not being managed, but you've got complete air traffic control. So you're really driving that, you know, that really good, really strong customer experience. So that's where, you know, in that scenario, we could say, actually, to be more customer centric, you need to completely recalibrate how you currently buy media. And if in-housing is only creating a silo, then maybe you need to step back, by all means, own the strategy, own your data, own your technology relationships, but maybe find that integrated partner who can bring all of this together. And just to go back to, I think it was Terry Kawaja at the ANA conference, and he speaks a lot about the future of agency models and, you know, makes a lot of predictions. And for him, you know, the future of the agency is in being a systems integrator. You know, what that means, you know, remains to be seen. But, you know, like with what publishers have done with Axiom and IPG and Epsilon.
Recently acquired.
I may have got those the other way around. But anyway, you know, in doing that, they're kind of well poised to be that kind of integrator and that kind of to provide that air traffic control, given that they have visibility
becoming the middleware everything. Almost, because, you know, that's what an agency is supposed to be. You are the agent between one party and another party. Yes. And actually becoming the systems integrator does make a lot of sense. It's how a lot of them started out, really. Yeah. Isn't it? So yeah, I mean, I do understand, and Terry Kawaja is going to love the fact that he's being mentioned so much in this podcast, but
name check to you, Terry.
Absolutely, name drop.
Well, frankly, it's quite nice to talk about someone else's industry predictions over Kieron's, because he's the other one that likes to pontificate about where we're going next. Sorry, Lindsay, I interrupted. Carry on.
No, I mean, I think that is a fair point as to what the role of the agency is going to need to be. But it's interesting for me as well, because obviously you, Ryan, in your role, you speak with agencies, you speak with brands. You have some agencies that say, you know what, in-housing just is not a thing. It just doesn't. We're not seeing it at all. We're not seeing our clients react to it in any way. Or those that have done have actually kind of gone and given it a go and gone, this has not worked. We need to come back to you. Don't tell anyone, but we're going to come back to you. And, you know, we'll just pretend that never happened. And others are going, actually, it really is a bigger thing than we thought it would be. And it seems to be the holdcos are the ones saying in-housing isn't really a thing. And it's the more independents that kind of work, have a slightly different relationship with the brands than the holdcos do, that are saying, actually, this is a bigger thing than we expected. What are you actually seeing in that front?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, whether the holding companies' clients are saying they're in-housing, what they are doing is looking at their operating model. You know, that in-housing may be an output of that, but, you know, it could just be that the way that we currently work with our agency isn't fit for purpose. You know, it may be, as we said earlier, too decentralized, too fractured, and we need to kind of bring that around, or we're too reliant on you, and therefore we need to find a way where we can kind of take a bit more ownership. You know, if I think about some of the fastest growing agencies, you know, these are digital agencies who are working hand in hand with clients who are taking, you know, who are becoming more self-sufficient. You know, look at where Sir Martin has invested. You know, he's invested in a company who is, you know, who helps brands to in-house. Now, you know, that's perhaps a bit of the zeitgeist, but what those agencies are doing is finding value where a client can't, you know, on their own. So even if
where the client needs it.
Correct. Yeah. So even if they bring paid search in-house, what an agency can provide is all the automation, all the scripts, all the workflow that, you know, with the best will in the world, a small search team in Slough can't do on their own. So, I think the fact that holding companies are saying that is probably symptomatic of the relationships they have or the types of clients they work with, and maybe the conversations that they're privy to. But, you know, where some of those fast-growing agencies and the D2C brands or digitally first brands, you know, they are all, you know, maybe not about in-housing, but just asking the question, do we have the right people, process, technology to be, you know, fit for the future, you know, fit for a very different future, which is, you know, we'll, you know, some holding companies will just have to, you know, we'll move faster than others. But, you know, if they're saying that, you know, they've got their fingers in their ears, and, you know, I think they're going to get a rude awakening.
Shock. Yeah. Just thinking about this for a minute from the brand's perspective, like you say, you spend your time at MediaSense looking at their operating models. Do you find when there is real transformation within a brand, frankly, whether that is to bring some things in-house that they haven't before or to take the decision that actually know they need to outsource or whatever, do you find that's very relationship driven, or is it an organizational thing? What are some, because it's something that we get asked a lot, frankly, by others across the industry who want to know what conversations we've had with brands and marketers.
Yeah. I think, you know, it helps to have, you know, an evangelist or, you know, someone who can galvanize a team of people around a vision. You know, I think where we've seen in housing go wrong is because it was just, you know, an individual, you know, a bit of empire building and suddenly just got away, you know, and ran awry. You know, I think the hardest thing for any in-house team is to drive accountability. You know, if you're going to create an agency, you need to be treated like one. You know, you need to hold them accountable like you would an agency. And therefore, you know, briefing and reporting and, you know, just, you know, calling those teams to account when maybe performance is off. And if as an organisation that you're not prepared to have a difficult conversation with Dave in the corner, who's just
some of your
overspent,
own staff.
Exactly, then again, you know, it's not right. So I think unless, to your point about relationships, it's really stakeholder management. And, you know, starting small, as I mentioned, those brands who've, you know, this has been as part of a journey, they started with one channel and then, you know, that's because they created a proof of concept, they got the buy-in, they got the adoption, they could use that to galvanize the team, get that trust, create those ways of working, you know, ensure that it is integrated with everything else that goes on. And then, you know, the rest of the process becomes a lot easier. And you look, agencies have to play their part there. Like I said, there is a lot of value they can add, you know, supplementary services. But perhaps saying it's the wrong thing to do or it's not happening is the wrong, you know, is the wrong stance to take. You need to think about where you can add value, you know, embrace it, you know, if that's where your client's heading. But, you know, you're going to build a longer term relationship if you can find those kind of little opportunities and be a, you know, truly, you know, long term strategic partner.
And also from your point of view, where maybe you've come across a brand, like you were saying, pretty much all brands are just looking to have better, more authentic, direct communications with their customers. And where you've come across a brand that's done that well, are there some characteristics that seem to sort of read across if you've come across a handful of brands that have done that well, for example, or are there some standout characteristics? I'm thinking of things like, I don't know, leadership from within that brand, you know, that sort of galvanizes everybody to get them, to keep them focused on the real matter at hand rather than getting carried away with the sort of nuances of relationships with your tech partner or relationships with your agency or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I think I may not name names. Perhaps
it's not expecting you to. I mean, you know, obviously, if you wanted to, that would be fine. But yeah.
I think, I mean, you know, I think a lot of brands have gone through some sort of media transformation over the last few years, and it probably started after the A&A fallout, and just the need that you know, we need to be all over transparency and just make sure we are doing things properly. And you know, Mark Pritchard and Keith Weed have played their part in that, and I think that's helped to give just better inform the market. But I think what that's forced a lot of brands to do is create their own media transformation agenda and actually be prescriptive to their teams and their markets about how we do things.
Yep.
And our expectations around transparency and quality and, you know, how we work with technology vendors and agencies. But it does, there's always a risk that it, you know, it just becomes a bit of an academic exercise and it's just a piece of, you know, it's just a set of guidelines or a playbook that just sits in the corner. And I think where I've seen it work well is where brands have created a vision, almost a strategic vision, which, you know, which can be translated into media. So whether it's about you know, making sure that data does not leave our organization because it is the most valuable thing, then that, you know, is an indicator of how we therefore work with partners and other people in the supply chain. You know, it may be to say that, you know, we are a customer first business. You know, we exist to delight our customers and create the best customer experience. Therefore, the way that we buy media and activate media has to tick those boxes, which therefore means we operate in a brand safe environment. You know, we serve, you know, to an acceptable frequency. We don't use excessive retargeting because it's going to irritate our customers and affect that customer experience. So it's a common, you know, of course you need to develop the processes, guidelines, playbooks, but that needs to be accompanied with a kind of clear vision that has buy-in from the very top, which therefore can be translated, whether it's media, whether it's PR, whether it's CRM or just general customer service, that all needs to ladder up to an overarching vision.
Yeah. Fascinating. I feel like really we could probably carry on for about another 40 minutes, but reckon time's up. But that's a really interesting conversation, Ryan, not least of all because it's the type of thing that we talk about a lot at ATS events as well. In fact, at our event coming up in Madrid, we've got a really interesting opening brand panel with some very different perspectives on that. Brand that's saying that they're bringing virtually everything in-house. So we're interested to quiz them on what that actually means because sometimes maybe this comes down to a definition as well of what you define as in-housing. And a brand that's working very closely with their agency to make sure that they've got the appropriate amount of, you know, that they've got the service partnership right and that they've got the appropriate amount of in-house activities in a, you know, in the way that they want it and are very, very customer consumer focused and operate like no other of their competitors in the field. So
yeah. Should be a good debate.
Yeah, it will be. Yeah. I'm sure this podcast will make mention, will be made mention somehow, even if it is in Spanish. Awesome. Thanks very much for coming in today, Ryan. It was really
pleasure.
Good to have you. Thank
really
you, Lindsay.
Thank you.
That was the Mad Tech Podcast.